Hello and welcome back to another episode of Binge List and Box Office Hits, the podcast about all things film, TV and streaming, with your host, Shannon Holiday, and me, Letitia Thomas.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Binge List and Box Office Hits, the podcast about all things film, TV and streaming. I'm your host, Shannon Holiday, and I'm joined in the studio once again with Letitia Thomas. How are we doing this afternoon, Tish?
We're doing great. It's good.
You're doing very well?
Yep, sure.
That's great. Yep. Nice.
I'm pepped up.
I know you are.
I'm like just trying to keep the energy, but it's like...
We've been chatting for a bit before we started recording. I'd say a good half an hour before we pressed that record button.
We got into delirium.
We had some gems in there. We're not going to cover some of it because it's definitely not PG and probably not appropriate for this podcast.
This is a family channel.
It's a family chat. But we had a good laugh at some of the stuff that we uncovered. Some things about ABC iView mm-hmm. and some interesting shows that they've got on there. Everyone I think needs to check out, was it Teenage Boss?
Yeah, with Emma Memmer.
Emma Memmer from
the X-Wiggle.
The Wiggles.
I believe.
Yeah.
Not my Wiggle, but one of them.
One of them. And we were on the website and not only did they have like you could click on the show and watch the episodes, but there was a downloadable spreadsheet for teenagers to look after their family finances.
Teenagers and me, apparently.
It was interesting because I opened up that Excel spreadsheet and I was just like...
You taught me what equations were
in the Excel spreadsheet.
Listen. I did not do business in school. I did it in grade 8. I got the subject award because I was good at it.
Was it like most... participated in?
No, I don't think so. I think I just got genuinely the subject award in grade 8.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, oh, I'm not continuing this.
Oh,
this is boring.
I don't like the math.
I wasn't even that. It was just like, oh, how fast can you touch type? I'm like, not
fast
because I don't have a computer and other things. I don't know, it was grade 8.
Yeah,
fair enough. 6 months. I don't remember.
They used to have games on our computers that were like touch type games so you could get quicker and quicker.
I think we probably had them too. Yeah. But again, I don't remember it and I don't know why I got the award.
Interesting. You know what they should be teaching in schools that they don't? I think they should teach things like taxes and accounting earlier.
I got taught that in grade 12.
Yeah, we didn't have that in our school.
You probably did.
New South Wales.
You're good at maths.
Yes.
So you would have probably been in math B or C.
Yeah.
Yes, I was in math A.
Oh, you're in the general math.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they taught us that.
Yeah, okay.
And navigation.
What, like GPS? Like how do you turn on GPS on your iPhone?
You if you're on a boat and you can see a landmark.
I know you guys are the stupid kids.
You can do trigonometry, which I was very good at actually. I don't know why, but you could do trigonometry and then you could figure out where you are on a map.
Yeah. It's all math.
Again,
it's all math. I love that.
Did I recall any of it?
This is why I picked accounting at uni. It's because, and a lot of people ask me this, and it's like, oh, you don't seem like the type to do accounting. You're like, yes, correct, probably not. Because I'm a little bit more creative than that. But for me, when I'm doing and studying something, it's the fact that I can, like, there's only one answer, right? Like, it's right or wrong. Like, yeah, the method can give you most of the points towards the answer in accounting stuff at uni. But there's only one answer, really. Like, once you get the final answer, that's it. Whereas I found, like, doing stuff like English and some other creative things, when it's so interpretive and, like, say you get one lecturer might say one thing to you, but if you get a different lecturer who studies your work, can say something completely different.
It's very subjective.
Like, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that. Whereas like accounting, I'm like, cool.
Oh, I understand like the marking of like, yeah, sometimes it's tricky, but the work itself I could do, so that was fine.
Yeah.
Math, not so much. But I also think I have the dyscalculia where the numbers are different, which I didn't know at school. I just thought, this is hard and why am I crying all the time?
So you see numbers differently?
I can't like, okay, so like at work, right?
Yeah.
Like your old job, my job, you'd be like, oh, this is like a stock code and you'd read me out the numbers and I'd be typing the numbers.
Yeah. Completely different.
They're not the right ones.
It's just completely different.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you got number dyslexia.
Yep.
Yeah, all right.
And I didn't realize until not that, like a couple of years ago, and I was like,
I see.
Oh, this is a problem. But at high school, I wasn't noticing it. Well, I think if I handwrite stuff, I do better.
It's different.
Because
you got to process the writing, yeah.
Yeah, but when it's anyway.
I see numbers in colours.
Yeah, you got synesthesia, which I think
I see numbers
is cool.
Colors.
No wonder you're enjoying it.
Yeah. I see certain numbers, colors. Like 7's yellow. I can't explain it. Like,
wow.
Any number, like pretty much 1 to 10 is associated in my brain as a color.
That's fun.
It's so weird.
And I don't know what this is, but I get sixes.
Yeah.
And the letter S.
Mixed up. Somehow. So you write the S instead of
a six?
Yeah,
I'll be writing tickets or something. And then I just like completely like effort. And I'm like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And my
my brain's done something in between there.
How do we get this far before we notice these things?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like how? Right? Like I did well in school, but I'm like, how much?
How did
like,
I pass?
Know I work hard, right? Yeah. But I'm like, how hard was I working comparatively?
Your brain was well to be getting back
like
then.
These grades and stuff. I'm like, Jesus, there's a lot wrong. Yep. But somehow, yeah,
we got through. We passed. We went both went to uni, and look at us now.
I passed Math B for 6 months.
Well done.
You know how
well
I passed?
Done. You looked at help. Got someone else to help you?
On my communication grades alone.
Oh, really?
So they'd be like, the math is wrong, but you explained how you did it really well.
Like, you nailed the fact that you got this wrong.
Like, I would, like, over-explain you're really it. I'd be confident. Like, and then I did this, and then I did that. And they're like, that.
Well done. We'll work on the other part later.
I just and then gave you left. Up. Yeah, I went through three teachers in 6 months.
Interesting. What a time.
I went to public school, so there you go. And there's stories that I can't tell on this podcast about some of those teachers, but anyway.
That's for another time.
Wild times.
That's for a special episode.
We went to ABC iView and we looked at...
Yeah, Teenage Boss, there some other go. Stuff. We were just talking about this,
sorry,
the
different long tangents.
The different diverse shows that we have in Australia and the way that obviously SBS is going. And I was like to you, I was like, SBS doesn't really need to push it that much because like what is it up against with 7, 9 and 10 and the reality shows that they only run
that's
on
the
that?
Thing, right? Like there used to be quotas for the broadcast and so much had to be Australian and then they scrapped that. Love them. So that's why everything that's scripted now is on a streaming platform, which is good, but also like there's just less of it because it's not like for the broadcast links and like there's no work and that's why I have a podcast in short.
Exactly right. Yeah. There's just less out there to be involved in than there was probably like 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's grim.
Yeah, it's a different landscape.
It's very different.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get into what we've been watching the past week. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I've had a very busy week with some work things. So I struggled to watch anything kind of outside a couple of things for the main topic for Phoebe.
Yeah.
But I did watch two movies, but I'll let you get back into yours because you got a couple more than me.
Yeah, I finished rewatching WandaVision because I thought I needed to. In hindsight, didn't get much that I was like, oh, I'm missing clues. I really didn't miss much. But then because I was on that train and I was kind of like not in the mood to watch much this week, I was just kind of like one of those weeks. So I was rewatching Agatha All Along because I was watching the first episode with zero context clues.
And then you watched it again.
And then I was like, I definitely missed a lot in that pilot because I was more like, what's going on? And when was this set? And what happened in WandaVision? And who's Agatha again? Anyway, so like I rewatched it and I was like, oh, this is very smart. Just the way that they sort of pieced things together without getting into the plot of it because I know you haven't seen it. It's a fun show. I keep like I'm watching it week to week. So much fun. They do practicals. Everything's practical effects. So like it's very little CGI. I mean, obviously there's CGI.
Yeah.
But there's very little CGI. It feels kind of like Wizard of Ozzy. Not completely, but just in the terms of like practicals. So they do like miniatures. They do painted backdrops.
That sounds cool.
The whole thing is like put together and it's just a fun time. Kind of feels less Marvel-y, which is good.
I've heard that, yeah.
I think. Because it's just like they had a vision for what they wanted to do with the show, which still is in line with WandaVision to a degree. But they just went, we just want to make a good TV show that happens to be within the Marvel world. So yeah, it's just really fun.
It's still on my radar.
Just hijinksy.
I will watch it.
Catherine O'Hara's amazing. She's in great. It. Like just so good. Such a like layered performance in something that's like silly, but like very layered. Aubrey Plaza, like
top notch.
Chef's kiss.
Top notch.
Those two like together in scenes with like 100 years old sexual tension.
Yeah.
It's off the charts.
Gotta check this out.
Yeah, it's worth the watch. Even if you're not really like a Marvel-y fan.
I think it's gonna be
worth it.
It's gonna be after Only Murders. Well, once I get up to date with Only Murders in the building is Agatha All Along.
Yeah, I do need to watch the later season of Only Murders, but I think I'll wait till like the
season's
summer.
Season's out.
Our summer.
Yeah.
Not recording.
Christmas time. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Speaking of which, I'm halfway through season three of Only Murders. Mm-hmm. I still agree with the fact that I think the first two seasons are a lot stronger than this season. The mystery isn't as entertaining of an idea. They kind of move the whole premise away from a murder being in the Arconia, which they all live in. I mean, it does take place in there, but it's mostly about a mystery around the theater aspect that one of them is running, Oliver. And the new characters aren't as engaging as the ones that live already in the building.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. Like, I like the idea of the sort of mystery of the theater. It's very, like, it's just, it like, theater is just superstitious, the whole thing. Yeah. And, you know, you've got, like, old stories like Phantom of the Opera is, like, a perfect example of the story of some, you know, haunted theater and deaths and whatever. But as a show, like, it's not as exciting.
I can see why they took
they needed to
the
change
show
it,
in that
I
aspect.
Think.
Yeah, like, they've done the same kind of, like, the second season was a, kind of like a clone of season one.
Yeah.
In terms of the mystery, like, someone dies in the building, no one knows who it is. The second one was one of them is accused rather than them just trying to work it out. And then the third season is obviously, yeah, it's related around the show that one of them is putting on.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine. I'll definitely see it till its end. I've noticed that the three main characters, their stories are more individual this season. Like, they're doing their own thing rather than when they're together. And I think the show works its strongest when all three of them are on screen together. But they're kind of doing their own solo kind of thing at the moment, at least in the first half.
I completely agree, yeah.
It's not as strong.
I do like some of their, like, the characters that are not part of the main ensemble. Like, what's that guy's name? You know, like, the really, like, campy guy that,
Howard?
Like, Howard.
The one with the caps?
Yeah, the neurotic.
He's honestly so fantastic. Funny. He's the greatest, like, side character in this show. He's hilarious. They've kind of, like, slowly crept him to become, like, a main character.
He has a lot. And I think I remember really enjoying his stuff in season three. I can't remember specifics.
He's the assistant.
But, yeah, there's just, like, moments of just insanity.
There's an episode where Steve Martin's character is doing a song, but he goes to, like, the white space or the white room and
that's
he blanks
right,
out. And then apparently he's just did, like, a massive abusive things. You don't see it, but then it cuts to when he finishes his act. And then everyone's, like, sitting there, like, pretty much traumatized. And then Howard goes, can I please go call my therapist? And then Martin Short's just like, yes, you can. It's very funnily done.
He's fun.
Yeah. Like, there's really funny parts in this, but cohesively, I think the first two seasons work best as the mystery. Like, I feel like the mystery of, like, the whodunit part has taken a back seat comparative to the relationships between the new characters.
Yeah, I think it's that common issue that happened. And I guess because it used to happen a lot later in TV. It used to be, like, season five, you'd usually have, like, a big switch up and, like, your lead would end up being, like, you know, maybe evil and, like, usually it would kind of happen once the leads had, like, got together. So the sexual, like, the unresolved sexual tension had been resolved and they're like, oh, no, what do we do? So they would, like, something would sort of happen and would cause drama there. But now everything's shorter. So I think it's happening, like, kind of season three where you go, I've got a really strong premise for season one. It can continue to season two. If we get a season three, which is such a doesn't really happen so often anymore. It's, like, more of a gamble. Like, we could go down this way, but then, yeah, it's hard to reinvent the wheel, especially in a show that everything matters. It's not like one of those shows we do 25 episodes a season. They do, like, filler episodes and bottle episodes and this episode means nothing, but it's really fun to watch. Like, there's none of that, so everything has to have meaning.
Especially, it's a murder mystery too. You look for things that happen in each episode, like any clues in that, but if it's not the center of attention just loses that spark.
Yeah.
But I've gotten word, like, I've read into, like, the synopsis of season four, and I've mentioned this in the previous episode, but it looks like they go back to, like, the murder mystery style, but not in the same building.
In the West.
They get flown over to, because they're in New York, they get flown over to LA and they go to the West Arconian building to solve a murder. Yeah. I'm like, oh, cool. Like, they're getting back to its roots, but it's different.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good.
I think that's going to be really good for season four. I think it's just season three. It's not yet again. It's not bad. It's just not.
It's not
at the quality of season one and two. So I'm looking forward to finishing that off to get into things like Agatha All Along.
Yeah, it should be good. Yeah. I watched a couple other things. I watched The Princess Diaries. My family had it on the TV, and I thought I'm sitting here, so I guess it's it. I don't think I've ever seen this film all the way through. I've definitely seen it a few times. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it. I was very little. Like, it came out when I was four. I probably wouldn't have been more than six when I was first watching it. And I don't even know, like, why. I was just, like, at someone's house and I remember it being on. And I remember being, like, just so encaptured by this story, like an Anne Hathaway.
I have no idea why. The makeover scene where she gets revealed.
Yeah, it was such a strong, like, core memory of something that I'd watched. Yeah. Maybe it was because I was seeing Julie Andrews in something as an older person, because I've probably only seen her in
Sound of Music
and Mary Poppins. Yeah. Like, I don't know what it was.
And Chris Pine, like, super young.
In the sequel. Well. He's in the sequel. Yeah, but yeah, in the first one, I don't think I'd ever seen it all the way through. And I was like, God, this movie's, like, long. It's 2 hours.
Yeah. Which is long for, like, a 90s comedy.
Yeah, early 2000s Disney. Yeah. Anyway, I enjoyed it. But again, I think...
They're doing a third one, I think.
I know. They're also doing a second Devil Wears Prada.
I read that
I'm
too.
I'm so excited. I was meant to bring this up a couple weeks ago.
What do you mean? Like, what are they going to do with that?
I don't know, but I'm very excited.
Do you reckon they'll bring back like Emily as well?
They better. Surely, she right? needs to go to France.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And I'm
they're going to bring back everyone that was in it to make it like the sequel. It's.
I think they are. I think they're all in the works, and I don't think any of them would refuse.
No, as
like
long as
Meryl's not going to refuse.
As long as you got Meryl on board and
Stanley Tucci, Anne Hathaway, Emily Blunt.
Yeah, if you've got all of them, it'll be pretty good. I like the first one.
Oh my God.
The acting was superb.
It was the first, and I guess we'll talk about this in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the first like adult movie I watched as a kid. Like, and I don't mean adult as in like, oh, it's scandalous, but like a story that
just
wasn't
mature.
Pitched for children at all. And I remember watching it going, oh, this is Meryl Streep. She's amazing. Mm. I knew of Anne Hathaway, obviously. And then, yeah, I loved it.
It was really well done.
Deeply loved it.
I think it's accessible to anyone. Like, you don't have to be, you know, into fashion or like into the other actresses' roles or anything, or like follow Meryl's career or anything. Mm-mm. I think it's just an accessible movie and it's quite funny.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
It's very good.
But yeah, and then I watched The Little Hours last night.
I didn't realize yesterday. How many people I knew in this, because I looked at the cover and I was like, oh, I have not even heard of this
Alison
film before.
Alison Brie, Aubrey Plaza, James Franco,
is this where
Kate
they
Mikushi,
met?
Maybe?
Because they're married.
I think I've pronounced her name wrong. Nick Offerman. There's a bunch in it.
Yeah.
It's a very weird film. It's set in medieval times in Italy, and it follows some nuns that live in a convent, and there's a servant man played by Franco, and he works for the king, Nick Offerman. And he's been sleeping with the queen, and Nick's like, he's going to die, basically.
Yep.
And so he runs off and meets the guy that's running the convent. I can't think what his title is, whatever. And probably like a priest or something. And then he's like, oh, I need a place to stay. And he goes, oh, you can stay in the convent. But you can't talk to anyone because you can't tell them what's happened on the road because he lost some stuff, the guy. And so he's playing a deaf mute. And basically it's just about the nuns trying to sleep with him. It's very crass. Very odd
I would
tone.
Expect that from
quite
the
fun,
people that are in it.
Yeah, it takes a turn I didn't know it was going to take.
Like a dark, sinister turn? Or like a dark comedy kind of
route? Yeah, it's completely dark comedy. Like,
okay, great.
Yeah. It's just a bizarre film because it's not a comedy in like a ha-ha.
Yeah, it's
I'm
not
laughing
like
every 5 minutes. It's not like jokes.
Laugh. Yeah.
It's just like absurd.
It's absurd. Like funny.
Yeah, it's kind of... Taking the piss a bit about Catholicism and what it would be like to be a nun and you know, you swear your life to God and to be holy and to be faithful and all this stuff. But I guess not everyone that ended up in these places actually, you know, were genuine and meant it. So I think, you know, they sin a lot, but they're also in this. It was a weird film. It was fun.
It was
a lot of fun, but yeah.
Why did you pick this one?
I was looking for something to watch. I'd heard about it a long, long time ago, but then forgot about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I'd just seen Aubrey Plaza and a bunch of stuff the last couple of weeks, like Megalopolis. And then I was watching Agatha All Along and I was like,
I want to watch something else. Yeah.
I want to watch something else. Yep. It was on a streaming service or something. I think I watched it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Binge, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's on Binge.
But I was just like, oh, I'll just watch it.
Yeah, cool.
And yeah.
Which is kind of leads into why I watched The Predator.
Okay.
Segue. No, so I saw this pop into Netflix and I remember reading how kind of awful this one is. And it's one of the only ones I haven't seen in The Predator.
I haven't seen any.
You haven't seen any? Mm-hmm. The original?
No, nothing.
The original's the best. The one with Arnold Schwarzenegger and like that really iconic arm slap shake.
I've got no idea.
So good. It's just like two muscle arms like. Shake it. I'll show you later.
You have to because I don't know.
Literally look up Predator arm shake.
Okay.
And so I watched this one. It's from 2018 and it's got a bunch of different people in it. It's even got Jacob Tremblay in it, you know, the kid from Room. I was like, all right, let's see how bad this is. Oh. In terms of, you know that one? Yeah, that's from Predator.
I did not know.
Yeah, okay.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's got Carl Weathers in it as well. So this one, yeah, it's so weird. It's directed by Shane Black, who was actually in the original Predator movie as one of the like army guys. And so you think that someone who is in the original one would be like, yeah, okay, I understand the Predator movies.
Yep.
No. It's like a weird mix of like 90s action horror, like cheesy 90s ones, and like today's like family drama movies. It's so weird. And the CGI in it was awful. Like for 2018, I was like, no, that's unacceptable.
They had $2 in a dream.
Literally. They just put a lot of smoke in the scene, so you would be distracted by the actual CGI that's happening. And like one of the Predator characters has like two dog predators as like hounds to go find them first, like find the humans. They're so poorly designed. Like it's just so bad. The story's all over the shop. You can tell this was really hacked up in editing as well. It's a bit of a mismatch of like, oh, these people are like the mentally unstable soldiers. They're all being put on a bus to kind of go to like the mental asylum. Anyway, things to do with the Predator makes them all kind of come together and like go on this journey to save one of their kids, which is Jacob Tremblay. So they're all on this journey together and it's just so bad. It's got from Key and Peele, it's got Key in it as one of the mental cases. And
which is a professional term in this
professional
film.
Term for people with mental issues. And it's got a bunch of different ones. They're all like got neurotic issues. And it's got Olivia Munn in it as well as like the love interest.
Olivia Munn, why does she ring a bell?
She's in a bunch of different stuff as like never really the lead. You would know her face if you saw it. She's in it as like the love interest. She's a doctor, of course, or scientist. And she's like, oh, it's doing this or doing that. She's essentially there to be the exposition dump
The story
to move the plot along. And so it's really poorly written as well. But I watched it with Ben and his partner was here as well. And we're all watching it and we're all just having a fun time commenting on how awful it is. So like when you get a movie like that, that's really bad. You can still have a fun time.
Yeah.
Watching it for how silly some of the decisions that they've made making this film are. So I actually had a good time watching it for how awful the movie is.
Sometimes that's great though. Sometimes the worst movies, you can have the best experience.
100%. I'll see some of the guys that I used to work with at a previous job. We'll literally, it's like a bad movie watch night. We'll pick like some like awful like C-grade film. We'll get food and we'll just watch it and comment on how awful these films are. And we have a really good time. I think we watched Troll and Troll 2 one night. Oofed.
Okay.
So they're like 80s films, yeah. Like horror. I think the first one has Elaine from Seinfeld in it, in one of her first acting roles.
Oh, really? That's
in Troll,
cool.
Yeah. And she gets, there's one scene where she gets like brainwashed or something in one of these rooms and all the rooms are getting taken over by all this like vines and wilderness and she becomes like one with all
like
the vines.
Like Devil's Ned.
Yeah, kind of like that. It's very, very strange. But yeah, like watching old bad movies can be fun as well.
Sometimes they can be, yeah.
So that's what I did with The Predator. Yeah.
I did one more because it's Halloween. I watched The Love Witch from 2016. Do you know this film?
Yes. I've been meaning to watch it. Yeah.
So I'd seen this a couple years ago when it was out on Blu-ray at work and I was like, oh, this must be like a super old film because it looks like it's from like late 60s, 70s.
Well, I looked up the director.
It's not, yeah.
And she did something similar first and then she obviously made this. And I'm like, oh, it looks like they look the same, the actress who did this as the actual director. I'm like, oh, okay. So it's maybe it's a version of Viva that she did, but maybe different.
Yeah. I enjoyed this movie, but I also
didn't.
It ran too long. It was a 2-hour film. It could have definitely been an hour and a half, if not even shorter. It is visually stunning. It's one of the most specific styles I've seen in a film in a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. It feels 60s, 70s in terms of how they shot it. Like, I don't know if you ever watched like Bewitched or something.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
it
yeah.
feels like, you know, it's that overhead light.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, yeah, it's very stark. It feels like you're in medieval tarot cards almost.
Yeah.
It's about a witch in the title, and she like, you know, traps men and whatever. it's good in concept. It's stylistically stunning. I think it lacked a bit of story in that it kind of gets lost and I was in and out of it.
Yeah.
I was like, why am I here?
Especially if it's that long.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
It sort of dragged, but I'm glad I've seen it now because I've been intrigued by it for ages because I'm like, this just looks, it's so specific.
I've seen the cover of heaps.
Yeah. And I think.
I thought it was originally a 70s film.
Exactly.
Until I looked it up and I was like, oh, it's 2016.
Which is fascinating that they were able to capture that perfectly. Like the production is stunning. Her vision as a director is insane. I just think, it was a bit long, which is probably
where it just comes down to tightening and editing, which is fine. I think
they could have cut a fair bit out and still kept it. Like, it still would have worked as a film. They could have just, maybe got rid of one of the men that she interacts with and has sex with and kills. Like, if they'd cut a story, it probably would have.
It wouldn't have affected the end result. So,
it could have got there faster. Yeah. But, it is what it is.
Live and learn. She's still pretty much pretty early days in her career. So.
Not a bad film if you are curious.
I will check it out. I think it's on Broly.
Yeah, I think it's Umbrella. It's on Broly, but I think I watched it on Canopy, which is the library one, because I had free credits. So.
Why not? My last film for the week is one I watched last night. It's I've heard nothing but good things about this.
Yes, I did want to hear what you have to say because I was about to watch this, but I changed my mind.
Watch it.
Is that horror?
No, I would say psychological thriller.
Okay.
Not horror. It's called It's What's Inside.
Mm.
And from this year, it went to Sundance early in January and then it got bought by Netflix after that film festival. So they snatched it up really quickly. Apparently, it's one of the bigger things they've paid for out of Sundance. Wow, this is really good. And it's hard to kind of go, this is what it's about without ruining anything. But let me just think about how to say it. It's a group of friends who come together for essentially a bucks party or it's the night before a wedding and they're just reuniting with the groom. Essentially, they're all friends with the groom, not the bride isn't a part of it. And old things come up and stuff and they play some party games. Some of the party games kind of divulge into kind of crazy kind of things that happen throughout the night. I can't really say much more without giving away spoilers, but what I will say is to anyone listening and yourself is to watch this film and to go in completely blind. Not knowing anything about this film will actually make this experience really good. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. The acting's great. There's heaps of neon. Yeah, the different shots that they use and stuff. It's really, really unique in what they've done with the teen thriller. Similar vein to Bodies, Bodies, Bodies that came out. I would say it's spiritual successor to that. So if you've seen that and you kind of enjoyed that kind of whodunit mystery, it's kind of that but with less of whodunit.
Okay.
But it is a whodunit.
I'm really excited to see this one. I also need to watch Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. I've still not seen it. Yeah,
really good. I really enjoyed that from 2 years ago.
Yeah. You know what I've been really trying to watch lately, but I can't get it anywhere right now. Mm. And it's I Saw the TV Glow.
Yes, that I'm is going waiting. To biff.
Still waiting. Is it?
It's going to biff. I have seen it.
We had a weird distribution for that in this country.
Yeah, it's been very strange.
Very weird.
Went to biff. I have a feeling it will come out later release.
Yeah.
But I saw it through means of
free
access. Yeah, that's good. It's getting pretty good reviews out there. I saw the TV Glow. It's called a horror. It's not. It's not in any way a horror. Yeah.
I've been waiting for it to come to Australia. I mean,
it's an allegory about the trans experience.
Yeah, right.
It's
Matrix. No.
It's an allusion to it. Mm-hmm. And obviously the director and writer is and just talking about that experience, but putting it in a way that's kind of
it's
explains it in a metaphorical way.
Yeah, so it's accessible to all.
Yeah. So it gets a bit absurdist at times, that movie, but I quite liked it.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's it for me.
Pretty much us, yeah.
Yeah. What I will say, obviously, just to wrap up that last movie is, it's just got added to Netflix. Please go out of your way to watch this. You might not know any of the actors in it. It's got Alicia something out of Fear of the Walking Dead, the Australian girl.
Oh, Deb Carey or something Bridge, like that.
Yeah, something like that. And she's in it. She's the only real name I know out of it. But it doesn't matter. They all do a bang up job.
Yeah.
They're all really cool. So check it out.
Yeah, no, I will. Maybe, I don't know. If not tonight. before next week.
Yeah, if you do, let me know.
And yeah, did you look into anything about Megalopolis? Because we did tell the people we were going to explain it. Did you?
No, I got nothing else. I asked a few people throughout the week if they were like seen it or know anything about it, and I was like, if you have, please. And no one had anything. No,
I because I watched a couple clips from good old Francis Ford Coppola because I was like, what was that? I understand it now from a like thematic point of view, and so now I understand why the certain things were happening, but also like, what the hell was that?
Still nothing extra.
Nothing. I think I found like kind of he wanted to tell a story that talks about futurism because he's you know into the future and he's always looked to the future. He's got great grandchildren and stuff like that. And I think they're very important to him. So he did want to talk about that and what we leave for the future generations and that kind of like context, which you kind of see at the end, you know, it's all for the children with that little baby, but also like
what?
And then I was started reading some stuff about it and like Aubrey Plaza had come and said like, it just felt nuts. Like every day it was like a battle. And she was like, this whole thing's so insane that if I don't do it like perfectly, I'm going to end up on the cutting room floor. Yeah. So she just went into it like it was like a marathon and like
she was the standout. She stayed in
character
though.
The whole time because she was so afraid of getting out of character and like losing it and getting a stuff cut. And I think she was just stressed and insane. And she's like, it was weird working with him because like 1 minute you would be thinking, okay, I'm going to get it going and we're going to do these scenes today and I'm going to, you know, get through the pages and whatnot and I just have to do it. And then Francis would probably be like, let's play a game today. And she'd be like, what is happening? What if you were playing a game? So I just think it was all mental. Her and Shia LaBeouf, the sex scene in it, spoilers, was not perfectly really scripted. It was just kind of, I think.
Oh, you get that as well.
And so they went and they workshopped it,
if
which
anything.
You can tell.
Yeah, but it's more authentic. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if it's kind of like if they've constructed it themselves, I think that makes you know, a scene more believable.
I think so, like, especially when it's like an intimate scene with people. Well, obviously, you want to work with. Intimacy coordinators
the most
now.
Intimate
no, well, scene. Not this one, not the way they played it. No. But I think
amazing, like, hilariously done.
So funny. Yeah. It does help. If I mean, as a director, you probably want to have a, you know, this is the kind of thing we want to aim for. But then I think to a degree, you probably have to let
them do their thing.
Like,
a
this
bit.
Is what I want to do, and this is what I don't want to do, and this is, you know, which is why intimacy coordinators are now there. Important because of history
what's happened in the past. Yes,
just nuts stuff going on, and
I
don't really understand
those
film.
Two characters were, for me, were probably the two standouts.
I think so. I think because the concept was so absurdist, you needed actors to play it with a bit of like a just absurd energy because then it felt like, okay, they're in this world.
They matched the tone.
Yeah. If you played it too straight, it just made you aware of the fact that everything was a bit
off. Yeah.
I've
seen something recently on, I think it's Instagram, and someone's like put up a parallel between Megalopolis and a few scenes and a perfume ad.
It feels like
and
it.
How much it's, how
it
closely
feels like it.
It's similar to a perfume commercial. I was like, oh my God, it's exactly like that was scene by scene. it feels like a 2 hour, 2.5 hour long
bizarre
perfume commercial. Yeah,
I did see a bit where, and I should have looked into it, but I got distracted. But you know how there's like moments in the film where there's the three panels.
Yeah.
That was a reference to early cinema.
Yeah.
And some of the cameras, I can't think which one. I'm sorry, I'm not a cinematographer.
And that, it's just an allusion.
And
to
it was
that.
Okay. So I'm like, okay, that makes sense. From
I can appreciate that, and I appreciate the movie.
I appreciate it.
It just wasn't cohesive. I think that's the only thing that it's lacking. I think everything else kind of is there. There's parts that are great. It's just not a cohesive plot. But that's only one aspect that doesn't work. I think,
unfortunately, it's the most important.
It's probably the most important for general moviegoers, but like I think cinephiles can really appreciate what he was trying to do, his vision, everything else that's in there. Like there is cinematography choices that are really good.
I feel like for me, and look, I'm not an expert. I'm not Francis Ford Coppola, so I'm not telling him how to do his job. But I think
you're not telling the person who made Godfather how to do their job.
Okay. No, but I think if he'd lent into surrealism a little bit more,
yeah, I think
like
so
a bit
too.
More Fellini-esque, as an example, it would have helped.
Yeah, I think so.
Because we wouldn't have been expecting something so linear.
I agree.
But it plays like it should be linear, but then it's more like jump cuts as opposed to
It is.
Yeah, a cohesive story. Anyway, that's us on Megalopolis again.
Yeah, anyway, I think we can talk about this for years and still not really know the full story.
God help us when we get to a Francis Ford Coppola episode. We're like, so he's done some great things.
So he's done some amazing
Apocalypse
things.
Apocalypse Now, The Godfather.
He's done Jack.
No, Megalopolis.
And Megalopolis.
Okay. Anyway, right. Should we get into it this week?
Yes.
All right. So like a long time ago, I put out on our Instagram like what you were into and we wanted to see your favorite like directors, shows and stuff. And one of our fans of the podcast, Laura, said she loves Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Fleabag. And I said, well, I love Fleabag. So Shannon.
We're doing it.
Shannon's going to love Fleabag. And Laura sent me a photo of her magnificent
Fleabag tattoo.
Yeah. And wow. That's all I can say. It is beautiful. I love Fleabag.
As I spoke to you today, this morning before we recorded, I've watched 11 out of the 12 episodes of Fleabag.
You guys, you couldn't do it for
2 days. I have one episode left to go, which is the finale, but I've got an understanding of Fleabag. I've watched 95% of it.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. I don't think we should get into Fleabag just yet, but we should talk about her as a whole.
I think so, yeah. I very much appreciate Phoebe Waller-Bridge as a creative.
I agree. I think
done for film and TV and women in film and TV. And I know that sounds really wanky and I don't want it to sound like that, but
she has.
She got popular from, you know, in the masses, Fleabag a few years ago. Mm. But it was at a time when the industry was like, you know, capitalizing on marginalized voices, so to speak. And they were like, oh, women. And women really had a moment in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's done incredible things for it and just like, kind of, you don't have to tell one story. You don't have to tell one type of character for what women can be. And I think she's been doing a lot of work over the last few years. And I think
she's
made a big change.
An incredibly strong writer.
Yes.
I've gotten that just from Fleabag itself because she's obviously written and directed it. Because it was a one-woman show.
It was a one-woman show, which I've read. I read it this week.
Yeah?
Yeah, I found it. I wanted to watch it, but genuinely, it's not anywhere.
I was going to say, how different is it to the show?
Scoured, like... legitimate sites I tried to look to pay for. I looked to just find it online. I looked up like slime tutorials, which is the thing that you use in YouTube to watch like plays because they can't put that it's like a copy from Broadway and stuff. I went to the depths of the internet and could not find it. I was like, well, whatever. I managed to, yeah, get the stage play and I read that like in probably like an hour or something.
Yeah.
It's incredibly similar. Very different.
Obviously it'd be season one. Yeah.
It's very similar, but it's quite different. And that came about because she and her friend did a lot of stage stuff over the years, and they used to do different experiments to see what the audience, at what point they laughed, at what point they cried, at what point this, and they would do stuff where they do like interactive theater,
yeah,
where they'd give the audience like a balloon, and you know when you laugh or like maybe not laugh because you hear that, but like when you cry or something like let the balloon go, so they could
so you could see
these
get
balloons
evident, yeah.
Work out at what point audiences were affected.
It's like a test subject.
Oh, absolutely. Because she'd done a lot of stage and radio and stuff. And from that, I think she got given, I think it was a dare to write something. And that's how Fleabag originated.
It came about, yeah.
And then, yeah, she did the one woman
show.
Stage show, yep. Which is quite similar to season one.
In the beats?
In the story. Yeah, it's still about her friend.
You can tell that that's why it's stronger than season two because that's the story,
yeah,
right? It's
and about she her friend. Had like a secret that kind of stays that whole way of narrating. A lot of it is almost taken from it, even a lot of it as well with the, I'm not even sure what his title is, but the guy that's going to give her money, the bank manager
or whatever
he is. That's very much in it.
Yep.
Seem like, you know, scene by scene, like she takes her shirt off and she's like, oh, I'm not wearing anything.
That is so funny in the show.
So funny.
I wasn't trying to do anything.
And he's like, I've just been in trouble for touching someone's... Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
I found with this show, I feel like every other... Like, not there's not many nice characters to her.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, she's obviously interacting a lot with her family and a lot of, like, sexual relationships as well. There's not many nice people that she interacts with, but I think that's obviously... It's a connection to her guilt and like and her grief is she probably feels like she deserves that kind of attention because although this this show is incredibly funny, there's a simmering sadness to it the whole way through it as well.
So sad. And I think that's what makes it work. And in the stage play as well.
Yeah.
She's telling it because it's a one woman show. She's controlling everything. Everything you see through her lens, which is what she had to crack for the TV show. And I just think it's, again, you said she's a brilliant writer, and it's so smart because she takes you on a journey. Everything, when you're obviously watching the show.
She does do that break the fourth
wall. You see it from
situation as well.
An outsider perspective, which you didn't get in the play.
Yeah.
But you're seeing it through her lens because she'll look at you and give you a cheeky wink. Yeah,
and that's the...
She tells you what she sees, in, like her controlling the narrative, which would be like, this is what's happening. And then you can very clearly see it's absolutely not is what's happening.
Yeah, which is very funny when it's
done
right.
She's not in control. Yeah. But she's taking you with her, but it's in a way that makes you complicit because you like her.
Yeah.
And you're on her side. And then, you know, you're following her the whole way, but she's keeping something from you because she wants to let you in, but she doesn't want to let you in. Yeah. So, you know.
You get glimpses of the flashbacks with her friend.
Her friend Boo.
But you don't have the full story. All she didn't say in the end of season one when she's in the cab is obviously the cabbie's asking about it. And then she just in a lighthearted way says that her friend died. She jumped in front of
a bicycle
and three people died. But she says it in a way that's like, she's so silly. Oh, that's so funny. You can tell there's this deep sadness or grief it. But she's not giving the full story. And then that's pretty much, you just get little snippets of that through the first season and you kind of finally find out what the full story is in the last episode.
Yeah. And it just,
and, obviously it comes full circle with the bank teller as well, which is, I reckon, really beautiful way to sum up that first season.
Well, that's what she was doing really cleverly in this. And Fleabag, a lot of people go, oh, she's an unlikable character. But I don't think she's unlikable. No, I think she's very honest.
Yeah, and I actually really like her character.
Yeah, it's the perspective of a woman that's not, you know, clean cut. She's not this. She's just honest. And I like some of the conversations that are in the show, like, you know, being a bad feminist. Because, yeah, feminism's important, but some of it is so boring.
I think it's so funny. There's like, a quote in season two where she's like, I think I'd be more of a bad feminist. I had bigger tits.
I'd be such a good feminist if I had bigger tits. Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, that's so funny.
It's, yeah.
And then
just
when
an honest betrayal.
Her and her sister Claire at the seminar in season one. And everyone, and she's like, you know, if you could change your body, would you? And they both put their hands up and they're just in a sea of people that wouldn't. And they're like,
are we bad feminists?
Are we bad feminists? Yeah. And just like her relationship with her family is so funny. I love her and Claire where they're complete opposites, but at the end of the day, like
they are so similar at the same time. Yeah.
And I think
when they go to hug.
I see me and my sister in her and Claire.
I was
going to
say this. I'm like, this is literally you and your sister. Like you guys.
Yeah. And unfortunately I'm Fleabag.
Yeah. I would say that too, that Claire's definitely your sister. It was just so funny to watch the parallels. And I'm like, this is why you like the show because you can see yourself in
moments
Phoebe
Waller-Bridge's
character, especially with your sister. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, you would never go and hug your sister. But it was so funny watching them do it because that's exactly how you guys would be.
What do you mean?
Like, what are you doing? Trying to hit her away? Like, don't do that. Want to go out for drinks? No, I'm busy. And then she literally asks the next person who walks past, is like, would you like to go for a drink? And they just stare at her. It's very fun. It's very funny.
Oh, they're just, yeah, I think it's very smart and it's very sad. And I love even with her stepmother, played by Olivia Colman.
I mean, it's perfectly done, but it's
fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
God, she's horrible.
She's a horrible person. But she plays it so well.
She cast her knowing that she was going to get Olivia Colman because they were friends.
Yeah.
And Olivia Colman had seen the play and said, if you ever make something out of this,
role,
I want to be in it. And Phoebe's like, yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah, because she's so warm and lovely, but then she's just scathing.
Yeah, she's played it so well on the
nose. And their dad that just doesn't know what to do with the fact that
he's so lost.
They don't have a mother anymore.
He's just in a sea of women, but he just doesn't know how to deal with any of them.
It's just so funny.
It's so funny. What I will say is, a commentary I will make on season one is why she is the way she is and how she interacts with everyone else is because she is, like you said, so honest and such a certain way. She had a person in her life who was like her, who could understand her and pretty much get her on that wavelength, which was her best friend Boo.
Yeah.
This season is basically just observing her when she doesn't have that safety net.
No, yeah.
And how she interacts with the world, not having someone in her life that understands her.
Like, you're it now for her, but yeah.
And there's really, I think it's a season two episode, and it's once her mother dies, and it's just after the funeral, and she's like crying, and she's talking to Boo, and she's like, I've got all this love.
Oh, I And quote kills me.
She's like, I've got all this love for her. I don't know what to do with it. And her friend goes, give it to me.
Give it to me.
It sounds lovely. I would love it.
And then her friend's gone.
Yeah. And yeah. You find out. And then you're like, oh, Jesus, this character's gone through a lot.
That quote has always stuck with me. Mm. And yeah, I remember using it when my dog died because I was like, oh. And it's true. You're just like, what do I do with this?
Yeah.
That you, yeah. And it's so ridiculous.
So that's why I'm like, she's an incredible writer.
She's
so smart.
So smart.
Yeah.
And so. That's what happened. That's why season two took so long, if we're going to talk about season two.
Yeah.
Without spoiling the ending because you haven't seen it. But she – no, I'm just saying.
Yeah, no. I got one episode. I'll finish it today.
Just in time for the podcast.
Retrospective episode. Retrospective.
No, but she'd written season one from obviously off the one woman play with the perspective of she's got a secret and she doesn't want to let you in on it.
Mm.
And she's holding you at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously at the very end of the season, you find out her secret.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of doesn't know what to do. And then they picked it up. They wanted season two. Amazon did, because Amazon picked it up at the beginning because they did a pilot with a bunch of people that just were hanging around apparently that like very good at their job, like very good. And then they're like, oh, this is great. Looks fantastic. And she's like, cool. Well, BBC, we don't have the money to pay these people for the rest of it. So then – they got Amazon on board. So Amazon just gave them the money and just said,
just do it. Just do it. Yeah.
So that's why it went to Amazon. Yep. And then they wanted season two because it blew up.
Very well.
And it took her a couple of years because she's like, I don't know what to do with a season two because this was such a contained story and the structure works because there was a secret. And now you know it. So season two works on the opposite way where it's like you're now in on the secret, but like what do you do now? Now that you've let everyone in. Now what, you know too much and maybe you don't like her because,
And the character does go through a bit of a metamorphosis at the start. She's like, I'm not doing this and this. I'm abstaining from that. She meets the priest.
Oh, yeah, because that's what I love. She used, and I'll come back to the bit earlier, but she used sex in season one for validation because she was getting it nowhere else in life. Yeah. She could use that as currency, which is like, ugh, gross feminism. But
makes sense, right? Like it does.
It makes so much. She was using it for validation. She was good at it. And if I do this and I do that and do that, I can get him and that's great. And then we can go home. But then season two, it's like, oh, well, that's ruined my life. So I'm going to stop doing that. I need to show up for my family. I need to do this. Yeah. I need to do that. Blah, blah, blah.
Also, it was probably a guilt thing as well because it was the cause of the situation. Yeah. So I think there was more of like, I hate myself because of it. I'm going to keep using it because I hate myself.
I hate myself. Yeah. And if I stop and acknowledge it, if I stop, I have to acknowledge it.
Yeah,
and
exactly right. Yeah. So it was, it's yet again, it's deeply layered, right?
So deeply layered.
Yeah.
And she's just trying so hard to get through life, but with scathing wit to get her through. Just the way she looks at the camera and she just says like these horrific things, which we probably can't even say on this podcast.
I love when she's there in front of the grave with her sister and it's her birthday and she hands her the cake and says, she won't eat it. And then she does and she looks at the camera like this really weird, like, oh, she did. Like, look. Like,
yeah.
It's very funny. And she does that constantly throughout. But even like the subtle little lines, like they're leaving the grave and they see the grave guy who just goes and cries at random graves and she goes, oh, he loves it. He lives for it. He's here every day. And then the sister picks up on the fact and she goes, oh, you're here every day.
Yeah.
And then she just doesn't say anything and kind of move on.
Yeah.
It's just little things like that. And then you get more kind of like you get a bigger story chunk of her character, right? Just from that one line.
Yeah.
Genius.
But it's throwaway because she doesn't want you to know. But now you know too much about her life now.
Exactly.
By season two. And it's like, how does she try and keep you at arm's length
now
that you're in.
You're in the inner circle.
Yeah. And just the fact that she falls in love with a priest.
Mm.
Is just,
I think it's funny.
Beautiful. I love the sexy priest. The hot priest.
Hot priest. But it's funny because like you said, as an audience member, when we're now in a circle, but he's not.
He's not.
What you're seeing is what we were treated like in season one. Mm-hmm. So it's just like we're at the reversal and trying to see him trying to understand her.
Yeah.
And seeing her reactions to certain questions and how she doesn't answer and stuff. And watching him get frustrated and you're like, I get that. Mm-hmm. But like also just tell him. But then you're like, it's good. It's not as good as season one, but it's still very good.
Yeah, I think it's not as good in that season one was very intentional.
Yeah.
But it's like you couldn't have asked for a better season two because it's such a hard
ask to follow up
kind
on.
Kind of thing.
There is one shout out episode of season two.
Yeah.
It's the one, the women in business episode.
Oh my God. Yes.
She instantly drops the trophy. Oh. Instantly drops the trophy. Oh, and then she gonna has
to. It's the hardest episode to watch because I just go, oh God, I think that might have been me.
Me. And then obviously they give her the boob trophy and then she has to go chase her down the street to get it back. And then she's like, the old lady's like, I know martial arts. And then she has a drink with her. And then she kisses her.
Kisses her. I forgot about that completely.
It's so funny.
How did we both forget that she kissed a woman in this show?
It's so funny. It's like, because the old lady's like talking to her about like, you know, live in the moment, like live for it, like do what you want. You already know what you want, so just live for it. Mm-hmm. She just randomly kisses the old lady. And then they look at each other again and then they kiss again.
Yeah.
She's like, lovely, thank you so much, but no.
Are you a lesbian? Not strictly.
Not strictly. Very funny.
Very funny. No, but I think it's such a smart show. I love her, again, even in season two, like her relationship with her sister, especially that first episode when they're all at the dinner table.
And you understand what she's doing.
Yeah.
They're fiercely loyal, but they're also at odds at all times.
Yeah.
God, I can't stand her partner though.
Oh.
He's the worst.
He plays him so well.
Yeah. I mean, he plays him very well, so right? Like he plays that.
Martin.
Yeah.
Martin. He's going to be sung Jake.
Yeah, that the weird stepson who just keeps getting in the bath with her. Like, no.
Something's wrong with him, probably clinically, but no one wants to address it.
No one wants to address it. And then he gets really close to her and be like, make sure she leaves him.
Yeah. Like, what is going on?
So random. Like, there's just quirky little bits here and there. But yeah, she's fiercely loyal to her sister, but it's so weirdly competitive and aggressive at the same time. Yeah. It's hard to explain that relationship. They do have each other's back.
I feel that deeply watching it. I go, oh God, this is what I'm like with mine.
But it's also, it was hard to watch the end of season one when the sister says all that to her about the partner and then she takes the partner's side, which I was like, ridiculous. And then she says about her friend. I was like, oh, that's really bad take. I'm glad they got to build that relationship back up in season two. Because it's the strongest part of the show.
It is. Yeah. It definitely is. But I guess that's the thing, right? Like the people, your sibling, the people that are close to you in that sense that have known you forever, and I know I'm talking to you, but it is that thing where it's like, Shannon's an only child. But it is that thing where it's like, they are the ones that say the most, at times, horrific stuff. Horrific
things, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they probably know you'll always be around.
Yeah, it's just kind of it's brutal. Yeah. But yeah, that was Fleabag, I guess.
That is Fleabag as a whole.
Bunch of Emmys, nominated for a bunch.
It should. It's very good. It's very good.
And that was the same year that Killing Eve.
That's what was up. Have you seen? I haven't, but I obviously read the fact that she wrote season one.
She
of
was
Killing
the showrunner, season one of Killing Eve. I watched this when it came. I think I must have watched both things when they came out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure even how. Anyways,
I didn't realize that like each season of Killing Eve has a different showrunner and Emerald Fennell is season two.
Ish?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, I looked up there's four different and then it was Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Emerald Fennell and then two others. I was like, oh,
it was cool. Definitely the strongest in season one with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, not to her horn, but we are talking about her and she did a fantastic job.
Yet again, it's the first season is usually the strongest because this is an established idea, right?
I remember watching this. I was so into Killing Eve at the beginning. It's such a fantastic show with Jodie Comer and Sandra Oh.
Yep.
Sandra Oh plays a detective whose name has now escaped me, but I had it in my head just a second ago. And Jodie Comer plays Villanelle. And she's a detective looking for this serial killer.
Mm.
And Villanelle's obviously the serial killer. And they meet in the middle at one point.
Sounds like Heat.
It is a... I don't know if I've seen television that does a cat and mouse game so well as season one.
One of Killing Eve. I've heard very good things about it.
They meet each other and they're deeply, deeply at odds. Villanelle's trying to kill her. She's trying to catch Villanelle. Yeah, yeah. But there's something there that's a little electric and you don't know if it's...
Is it kind of like a situation where like Batman always needs the Joker?
It's sort of a sexual tension thing.
Yeah, okay. Well, you could say that about Batman and Joker as well.
You think I've seen...
Yeah, true, yeah. But like one always needs the other.
Yeah, and they meet in the middle and then there's something there that they both see in each other. And it's sexual tension but it doesn't establish well later before it even gets there. So you're not sure and they don't know what it is.
Yeah, okay.
But for some reason they're like deeply infatuated with each other, mm-hmm. and it's ruining both their lives because Villanelle is this serial killer that like just goes for it in this most elaborate, childish,
yeah,
just has fun with it ways. Like she's maniacal. And you know, Eve, what's her name, is like, you know, this no-nonsense detective with a husband and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly her focus is just on this, and it's just such a strong cat and mouse in season one, where even though she's trying to kill her, she's also kind of like
in love with her.
In love with her, but it, like it, yeah. but it's so subtle in season one because it's gonna take time before everything develops, and then it, you know,
it does.
It's very well. They were they. I think it ends up in it does in the end. It she in season four, which I don't even know if I finished it. Or maybe I did.
There only is four seasons, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I finished season four because I read reviews and
it tanked.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Even my grandma was like, I'm not watching season four. She used to watch it because it was, it was cool. on the ABC.
Yeah.
yeah. And yeah, I think they get together and then Villanelle gets killed in a very like historical lesbians always get killed way.
Oh,
it's
really?
Like it's a trope of TV.
Yeah, okay.
Which makes people very angry. To the point there's conventions now.
Interesting.
About it. It's a whole thing. It's a, yeah.
I'm assuming it wouldn't have gone that way if obviously Phoebe stayed on being showrunner for all four seasons, or like even if it didn't last that long.
You could feel after she left that it
changed.
The quality changed and the tense cat and mouse, which obviously is never going to last forever because.
No, you can't keep that heightened sense of tension. You can't
keep that, but it was outstanding.
Yeah. Interesting. I will watch this at one point, probably not for a little while, but it's been on my radar. I know people have been talking about it for a number of years and like obviously the quality of it, and now I know that it was written and showrun mm-hmm. by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, which makes sense.
And she's good at it, I think, because, and I didn't know this till recently when I started looking into her, mostly for this week. The reason Phoebe Waller-Bridge is so good at crafting stuff, and she's been hired to do a bunch of different jobs on off over the years and script editing and stuff, is because she did so much stuff in theatre, specifically looking at audiences.
Yeah.
And working out when.
What's the right time to do this?
Yeah.
When she knows do that. Yeah.
Structure just so perfectly as to when to give the audience something and when not to give them something to really heighten that tension. And she does it a lot where she, you know, like you disarm them with comedy and then you punch them with the drama.
And that's the master of it. Good writer. I didn't realize she helped write the screenplay for
No Time to Die.
No Time to Die, the last 007 movie.
Yeah, I think she probably got brought on as a script editor to fix it.
Yeah, just probably just to polish it up.
Script doctor, sorry.
The fact that she's involved with like that's incredible. Yeah, like because
she there's a lot that she's been involved in or hired to do. I don't think she's done all of it because obviously you know Hollywood's such a machine where. You know, they hire you, then they don't need you, then they need you, then they don't.
Yeah, she's still in the mix of a lot of things, which is really cool.
Yeah.
You've got written here, like, Crashing.
Yeah, I watched this a long time ago, and then I started rewatching it this morning because I was like,
why not? Work.
yeah, this one was done 2016. This was around the same time as Fleabag, but I think this must have probably.
Just before it,
probably. I would have been before Fleabag, definitely. This is a fun show. It's only six episodes. I think it was done for probably the BBC.
Yeah.
And it's a comedy series following the lives of six 20 and 30 somethings living together as property guardians of a large disused hospital, which I guess must be something that happens in the UK. I'd really
don't
know.
Yeah, they've got a lot of abandoned buildings that they're like oh, heritage. We'll turn it into, they can't do anything with,
So, it's just a bunch of messy, messy people living together in this hospital that's been sort of
And it's
reno'd.
Obviously the different relationship dynamics between the six.
Yeah, she's playing a character that comes to a party that's being held that they're not supposed to have because there's all these rules and regulations. Yep. And she's the best friend of one of the guys who's got a partner, but unfortunately she looks very similar to the partner.
Oh, okay.
And the partner's very like type A neurotic and she's very like manic pixie type.
Yep.
And that's sort of their immediate dynamic.
Yeah.
Throughout that, but then there's like six or seven other stories that
are going on in this place.
And this happened because she'd done a lot of different. I think most of the characters in this show were bits for different stage stuff she'd done, and different plays. And then someone's hired her and gone, "We want you to make a show, but we want all these characters in it. We like these characters that you're doing. Put them in it." So that's when she came up with the crazy sitcom idea of them being guardians of a hospital, and that's how she brought them all together.
That's cool.
But she said it was mental to write just because she had so many different
stories
and 20 minutes, six episodes to kind of fit that all in.
And to probably wrap them all up. And to wrap them all up.
Yeah, and she's like, it was very hard.
It's impressive though. It's on Netflix.
On Netflix.
That's cool. I didn't realize that.
If you're a fan of Fleabag and you've never seen Crashing, it's different.
I guess I'll have to.
Not quite as dark.
No.
But it's worth the watch. But yeah, she's done acting and stuff in the past on the stage and screen and a whole bunch of stuff. She was in Star Wars.
She was in Star Wars as one of the voices. She's done a couple of voices.
I read that. She'd never seen Star Wars. So she didn't know what a droid was. So she did it as a human. And they said, can you do it a bit more droidy? And she said, what's that? And then they told her and she did it droidy. And they went, we like the human version. That's how she got hired.
Really? Okay. Interesting. I mean, yeah, she's in Solo. She's one of the droids in Solo who's best friends with Lando. And it's like alluded to that he's like in love with, like they're in love with each other.
Right. I've only seen it once.
Very weird. But she plays it quite well. She also does a voice in the new movie If, mm-hmm. Imaginary Friends, as the little lady one that looks like Bo Peep.
I watched her in, can't think what the movie's called. Anyway, it's about Margaret Thatcher. I watched it last week and I thought she was in it.
Oh, yeah. I know the one.
Olivia Colman. She's only in it for like 2 minutes. So I was like, well.
It's like when Natasha Lyonne appears in Ad Astra. You're like, why is Natasha Lyonne in this for one scene?
I still haven't seen Ad Astra, but I think I've seen that scene.
You've definitely probably seen that scene. But, I mean, literally, it's 2 minutes.
The internet
Although,
exists.
A good movie. Apocalypse Now.
And then, obviously, she was in Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones is a big feature film that she's been in recently. I will say that, obviously, I really like Phoebe Waller-Bridge and now seeing her a bit more of her work. I still reckon she was incredibly miscast in this movie.
I don't think it did her justice.
No.
She's very good at... Obviously comedy.
Yeah.
And she's very good at drama, but I think...
Didn't even get a letter to do either of those things.
I just think the character wasn't strong.
No.
Which didn't give her much to...
To work with.
To really do.
Yeah, I don't think it's her fault. I just think it was just not a role that maybe should have been given to her or rewritten to match her vibe.
Yeah, I think...
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's just something was amiss.
It didn't work on her talents, I don't think. Yeah. Like, it's fine. It's good acting in a very... basic way, but I think she shines in other things and she didn't get to shine in this.
No,
maybe she wasn't meant to. Maybe it was supposed to be Harrison Ford's film.
Then why have her? Like,
exactly.
The film itself was
quite messy.
Yeah, it was. It's definitely wasn't what I was expecting when I saw this, given the time frame between 4 and 5 to make a story. I don't know. A little bit disappointing from a couple of aspects. It wasn't terrible.
No.
But it was a little bit disappointing. And yeah, it's just interesting that she's in it.
Yeah.
Like, why was she headhunted for a role in Indiana Jones if you're not going to utilize her for what she's good at? Very strange.
It was weird. I think she was originally meant to be in Amazon's Mr. and Mrs. Smith at one point.
She was. Yeah, I read that.
Which I've seen some of now, actually. A couple episodes.
Makes sense because Donald Glover's Lando in Solo.
Yeah.
So they obviously knew each other from doing Solo. But she... I think she had creative differences with some of the things in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, so she dropped out, and then obviously he continued being in it. And that's obviously released now. I haven't watched it yet, but
I've seen some of it. I watched it for the Emmys episode, but I've stopped.
What did you think?
I liked it. It's different.
Yeah. Have you seen the original movie? Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
It's sort of a different premise. Obviously, the original movie is they are together.
Yeah.
This is their new spies. They're hired for a job, and then they form a relationship.
Based on that.
Like an actual relationship based on their... Yeah. Spies together. So, yeah, I think hopefully it turns out good, but I don't know.
We'll see.
I'm excited to see what Phoebe Waller-Bridge does next. She's been working on some things at the moment. Yeah. I don't know what they are, but like, I mean, you can read IMDb, it's this title, but.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what she
does with it.
She does in the next,
I'm excited because I think I want to see some good stuff out of her, like in terms of like she's got time to write the thing she wants to write.
Yeah.
Because I think they're her best.
She's a writer first,
she's
and then she's
genius.
Not that she's a bad actress, but she's an actress second, writer first, in my opinion.
And I'm really keen to see where it goes because I think she does really cool stuff.
Yeah. All right. Excited.
And that's us on Phoebe Waller-Bridge. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at BingeList. And you can email us at BingeList and BoxOfficeHits@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good week, guys.
Thanks, guys.